Chapter 10. Love and Loss. When your dog needs another home, and when you need a hug. Catherine sat crumpled in my office, crying as if her heart would break. You could feel the hurt across the room, and I soon let my own tears stream down my cheeks. Her soft-eyed German shepherd, Tasha, licked her face while we talked about how difficult it can be to stop some female dogs from feuding. Her two female dogs, Tasha and Sinka, were both buttery sweet to people, but they had hated each other for years. Their fights had become life-threatening. The last fight took 10 horrifying minutes to break up after the family's third dog, a huge female Newfoundland, joined in. Figuring out how to intervene in a dog fight is no small problem for any of us. Where do you grab? How can you get in the middle without getting hurt? Imagine trying to pull apart three huge fighting dogs when two of them are determined to kill each other. In the last fight, Tasha had been seriously injured, and so had Catherine. Catherine had already tried for more than a year to resolve the problem, with little success. Sometimes you can fix spats between two females in the same household, but in the wild, either Tasha or Sinka would have killed each other, or one would have left for another territory. It was time to relocate one of the dogs, but the thought of splitting up the family was agonizing to Catherine. She loved them both, but she couldn't live knowing that another terrible fight, possibly a fatal one, was just around the corner. Tasha eventually did go to another home. Sinka stayed with Catherine. Like most psychologically healthy dogs who go to good homes, Tasha slid easily from one pack to another. She was a bit restless that first day with her new family, but she played ball, luxuriated in belly rubs, and ate her dinner as usual. Catherine, the human part of this mixed-species family, grieved Tasha's absence like a death. It took her days to be able to eat normally. She cried off and on for weeks. She's a perfectly normal, well-adjusted woman, but sending Tasha to a new home felt as if she were betraying her own child. It's been about 2 years since Tasha moved, and she's clearly doing well, basking in the love of her new family. Catherine knows she made the right choice. Tasha is happy in her new home. Catherine's remaining dogs get along well, and both she and her dogs are enjoying the peace that comes with a good decision. And yet, even years later, knowing that she made a good choice, Catherine has moments when the pain comes back, thinking of the day that her dog slipped so neatly into a new pack, when she herself felt as if her own had shattered. Greater love hath no owner. Some of the hardest cases that I see involve a loving, responsible dog owner who has little choice but to find another home for his dog. I sat in my office one afternoon, listening to a fireman sob because his dog had bitten his son, and it seemed clear that he and his wife had no choice but to rehome the dog. There sat this huge, brave man, someone who runs into burning buildings that the rest of us would flee in a panic, crying as if his heart would break. His little black dog licked the tears off his face. After they left, I slowly closed my office door behind them, laid my head down on the desk, and cried like a baby. I would have given anything to have been able to give them the tools to solve their problem, but I couldn't. Their dog had the worst personality possible around young children. He was nervous, hyper-reactive, and quick to use his mouth. He was terrified of anyone under the age of 12. The chance that their 6-year-old son would be badly injured again was extremely high. All I could do was tell it to them straight, that many behavioral problems can be successfully managed and sometimes truly cured, but alpha wannabe dogs, with no bite inhibition, the child had over 100 stitches, are not the kind of dogs that you can cure in a family with young children. I had been warned when I started as an applied animal behaviorist that most of the cases that I was going to see would be about serious aggression. I was prepared to hear about growls and bites and to work at a job that entailed some physical risk to myself. But I wasn't prepared for the emotional pain of helping people make decisions that broke their hearts. It wasn't a surprise to me how much people love their dogs. I grew up in a family of dog lovers, and I was raised by a mother who to this day loves dogs almost as much as life itself. So I wasn't surprised at how deep the love could be between people and dogs. After all, if people didn't love their dogs so much, they wouldn't come to see me to solve their behavioral problems. But even after 14 years, I am still overwhelmed at times by the raw pain that comes when my clients decide that they have to send their dog away. I can't take away the grief that comes when clients say goodbye to a dear friend. But I can say something that has helped scores of people in this situation, and it is this. Rehoming your dog into a situation where he will be safe and happy is not a betrayal. And yet, I've seen owner after owner who might have been sad in anticipation of losing their friend, but whose unbearable pain came from feeling that placing their dog in another home would be betraying a trust. But I don't think dogs interpret it that way. Luke's daughter Lassie is a good example. She was sold by the dam's owner to a single woman with three young kids who lived in Milwaukee. It was a good place for a border collie to go bad. Smart, high energy, but underemployed dogs always find something to do. It's just usually not what you want. True to form, Lassie drove her owner crazy by digging, barking nonstop, and recycling the kids' toys. Like most border collies, she was a terrible pet for a busy family with young children. The breeder agreed to take her back, and I agreed to foster Lassie while the breeder went on her honeymoon. When she returned, we'd both look for a good home for Lassie, where she'd get the mental and physical exercise that she needed. Lassie came to the farm at 11 o'clock at night, too late to do much, so I leashed her to the bed beside me and lay all night with my hand touching her soft back. In the morning, I took her outside with the rest of the dogs. Pip heard a rabbit up the hill behind the house, and the pack took off like some cartoon race of dominoes, black and white streaking through the golden brush of a Wisconsin fall. I don't know why I bothered to call Lassie's name. A test, I guess. Although what could be the odds of stopping a full-out charge from a dog you've barely met? She turned around in midair. I remember a black and white U suspended for an instant, and then she hit the ground running to me. She stopped just before she ran into my legs, launched herself yet one more time to flip-spin herself beside me, and looked up, grinning. That first morning she seemed a bit restless. She'd lie down and then get up, pad over to the window, and look for who knows what, then come back and lie down again beside me. There was no question that she was a bit unsettled. But this was not a dog in extreme distress. She romped and played and licked my face. She ate voraciously, fell in some doggy version of love with her father, and took to herding sheep as if she'd been doing it all her short life. By the end of her first day, she felt like my dog. I liked her so much, I called the breeder that very afternoon and asked her if I could keep her. Lassie seemed to like me too, acting as if I was her human within a few hours of her arrival. By the third day, you wouldn't have known that she hadn't lived here all her life. Lassie loves me dearly now. I'm sure of that. I am equally sure that if something happened to me, Lassie could be happy with someone else who communicated clearly to her, who rubbed her belly at night, and who had sheep for her to work. I am not saying it's acceptable to pass dogs around like an old paperback book. What I'm saying is that although Lassie needs someone who loves her, love isn't always enough. Every dog is different, and that means that, just as with people, every dog needs an environment that brings out the best in her. At 11 months, Lassie came to the kind of place that she was bred to be in, and her problem behaviors melted away. She neither barks nor chews inappropriately nor digs where she shouldn't. Lassie came home, thanks to an owner who was wise enough to see that her city home and busy life couldn't do justice to an active, bright little dog who was hungry to put her skills to work. Lassie's story is like that of hundreds of other dogs who accepted a new home with the same philosophical peace with which dogs seem to accept much of life. My own belief is that dogs are like humans and that they can form incredibly strong emotional attachments to others. As I said earlier, I have no problem calling that love. But unlike humans, dogs can switch attachments, if it doesn't happen too often, relatively easily. I imagine that it's part of living more in the present than we humans do. Perhaps it's an advantage of the very different intellectual state of dogs versus humans. If you think about it, there's no reason why dogs would interpret a change in circumstances as a betrayal by the humans whom they loved. Wolf packs can be quite fluid, their changes dependent on food availability and breeding seasons. Some individuals are driven out of the pack, while others choose to leave voluntarily. Even many species of primates leave their first home and move on to another when they mature. In chimpanzees and gorillas, the females are more likely to leave home for a new group, while baboon and macaque males usually do the traveling. Besides, as my associate Karen London notes, our own children leave home and form their own families eventually, too. It's not always easy in the short run, either for the one who's leaving or for the ones who are left, but it's ultimately for the best. I've come to believe that when an animal comes into our lives, our responsibility is to use our resources and intelligence to provide him with as good a life as possible. The trick is to learn enough about the dog to know what he needs to be really happy and to get our own ego out of the way. Years ago, it took me longer than it should have to realize that my border collie, Scott, would be better off at another home. I'm a professional dog trainer who's truly good to her dogs. I live in the country and I have sheep to herd. So what could have been better for a border collie? Besides, I loved Scott dearly. But he had to share herding chores for a small flock of sheep with three other border collies, and it wasn't anywhere near the level of work that he really needed. Scott wanted to work so badly that he herded the cat in the house all night long. It drove all three of us, me, Scott, and the beleaguered cat, equally crazy. Additionally, Scott was shy and hated new things, and yet I travel a lot, and my dogs are constantly exposed to new places, new people, and new dogs. He was stressed on trips and didn't enjoy visits from clients and friends at the farm. I eventually found Scott a home with 200 sheep that needed moving every day, few visitors, and two adult humans who adored him. I won't pretend it was easy. It wasn't. But 2 days after I drove away, with tears falling so thick and fast, I had to pull over to the side of the road. I felt 50 pounds lighter after a phone call confirmed that his new owners excused his quirks without a blink and raved about his herding ability and his sweet disposition. Scott was in heaven, my poor cat got a break, and I glowed with relief and contentment. Scott was a bit disoriented the first day on his new farm, as all animals, including humans, are when they're in a new place with new social partners. But also, like humans, once things become more familiar, dogs settle into their new routine, far better than we humans at peacefully accepting what's happening around us. If a dog truly needs a new home, either for his own sake or for the sake of others, what's important is to find the right home for him. It amazes me how many wonderful people there are out there who are not just willing but happy to help out a needy pet. I had a friend who was moving out of the country, and he was devastated because he thought he'd have to euthanize his 15-year-old cat. He'd just learned that she had diabetes, and she needed a lot of medical care, including injections from the owner 2 times a day. He was sure no one would adopt her, and that he'd have to put down his dear old friend. I encouraged him to have faith and advertise, and he finally did. He ended up choosing among 5 wonderful families who wanted to adopt her. No doubt some dogs are harder to find good homes for than others, and it's certainly not responsible to pass on a serious behavioral problem to an unsuspecting owner. Neither do I want to see people use this as an excuse to pass around a dog like a fruitcake. There's a limit to how often a dog can adapt to a new home, and it's important to try to find the right place on your first try. But if you find yourself unable to provide a dog with what she needs, you won't be betraying a trust if you find a way for her to get it. You'd be betraying her if you didn't. I see far too many underemployed dogs who are driving their owners crazy, always chewing, barking, never settling down. Some of them have physiological problems, but many of them simply need a purpose in life, and not going potty in the house isn't enough to inspire them. Other dogs do well with some people and not others. Perhaps you have a dog who is absolutely wonderful with adults but is terrified of children, and you're expecting a baby in 6 months. This is a dog who, if anything, would be grateful if you found him a home where he didn't have to cope with the stress of a toddler. That's not a betrayal. It's an act of love. Of course, it is possible to betray a dog. People do it all the time. They abandon them on quiet country roads or tie them to stakes and drive away forever with no intention of coming back. They dump them at humane societies just because they are sick and old, with little regard for what might happen to them. The ease with which some people abuse their dogs is a painful reminder of the dark side of human behavior. But I think that dogs can also be betrayed by the people who love them, by owners who want a dog themselves so badly that they're unable to consider what the dog actually needs. Even the best of owners can't provide the right environment for every dog. It's cruel to cast off a dog like an old sweater. But it can be responsible and loving to acknowledge that no matter how much you love a particular dog, you can't give her what she needs. Dogs don't get to decide to leave the pack if it's in their best interests. Greater love hath no owner if you're willing to place that bored, unexercised little golden retriever in a home where she'll truly be happy, even if it does break your heart. Grieving. I learned that my dog Misty was sick Thursday night. By Tuesday night, she was dead. Although she was a fine-boned little border collie, she was tough as nails, and I had always imagined her living to age 16. But at 12 and a half, she started losing weight and began to eat her food gingerly. I thought perhaps a tooth was bothering her. My vet suspected something serious from the beginning, but allowed me the luxury of a few hours of ignorance. "Let's just x-ray her to be sure," he said. "Why don't you come back in a few hours?" When I returned to pick her up, my mind fussing with my own client's concerns and the next day's lecture at the university, Dr. John's face stopped me in my tracks. It had the quiet stillness you see on the face of a kind person who was searching for a way to tell you something painful. She had hemorrhagic sarcoma, a hideous cancer that had turned her liver into Swiss cheese and had filled her body with bloody tumors. The next day, the internist at the University of Wisconsin Vet School said that Misty could last weeks or die in 5 minutes. She started bleeding out that weekend, internal hemorrhages that couldn't be stopped. I spent the weekend rubbing her belly, feeding her chicken, and crying bittersweet tears of love and sorrow. Gradually, her belly swelled with blood, and by Tuesday morning, I saw that she couldn't rest comfortably anymore. She shifted position constantly, trying to find comfort in the middle of the dining room, a place she'd never lain in the entire 12 and a half years of her life. Dr. John came to the house that night, and while I held her and cried, Misty died. I let her body lie in the middle of the living room, where we had put her down. Pip, her granddaughter, was the first dog to come over to her body. Pip was the dog that Mist liked best. For that matter, Pip was the only dog that Mist liked at all. Misty loved people, but other dogs were the bane of her existence. Pip's submissiveness was a balm to Misty, who was the ultimate alpha wannabe, insecure, afraid of getting hurt. Misty nonetheless wanted to rule the farm, and she coexisted with the other two female dogs only because she had to. Lassie and Tulip aren't as submissive as Pip, and had no intention of sucking up to the bully that Misty could be. Aware of the tension, I carefully rewarded polite behavior and continually kept an eye out for signs of trouble. Every few months, Mist would laser a hard-eyed look toward Lassie or Tulip, and I had learned to respond immediately. Mist would find herself on a downstay for an hour, and I'd tighten up the rules at the farm for a few weeks. Pip circled Mist's body for the longest time, staying a foot or so away, never leaning in to sniff or smell her. After continually pacing around her body, Pip finally settled down with a loud sigh right beside her, face impassive. She stayed there for more than an hour. Lassie, whose face is more expressive than that of most humans, looked appalled. She hid behind my legs, occasionally peering out from behind my knees, sneaking looks at Mist and then instantly turning her head away, until curiosity overwhelmed her and she peeked again. She stayed farther away from Mist than she had when Mist was alive. I have no idea what was in her head, but she looked terrified. Lassie behaved as a dog would if she couldn't understand what Mist was doing, and while a predictable Mist was trouble enough, an unpredictable Mist was downright terrifying. Luke, on the other hand, didn't visibly acknowledge Mist's presence. He didn't look toward her or go to sniff her, but neither did he go out of his way to avoid her. She simply seemed not to be there at all. He looked for his toys, sat beside me practicing his noble collie look, and waited for another chance to do the chores. Mist lay in state all night. 3 times that night, I padded downstairs and stroked her soft black fur, sometimes crying, sometimes not, trying to bridge the gap between life with Mist and life without her. When dawn came, the dogs awoke to find me sitting beside Mist yet again. Pip had by now sniffed her all over, off and on all through the night, and perhaps found no reason to come over yet again. Lassie still darted back and forth like a filly thoroughbred who'd seen her first freight train, round-eyed and snorting. Luke continued to look oblivious until I finally called him over, patting Mist's flank with those little short taps that get a dog's attention. Luke bent his head down to sniff, and then threw it up as if shocked. His eyes rounded like pancakes. He looked straight up into my eyes with an expression of pure amazement, and then sniffed every inch of Misty's body. He nuzzled her, pushed her with his nose, whined, licked, all alternated with looking at me, straight into my eyes, as though asking a question. It's been 3 years now since Miss died. I still miss her delicate little muzzle, her Don Quixote obsession with herding pigeons, her sweetness to people. I've been crying a bit while I wrote this, Mist's death being close enough and her life big enough to have these memories still swell my heart. Luke is lying in the middle of the living room, right where Misty lay that long black night. If there were ever a time when I was allowed to learn what a dog is thinking, I would ask him what he thinks happened to Mist, where he thinks that Mist is now, and whether he misses her. It will be a long time before we understand what's going on in the mind of dogs when one of their social circle dies. I've had clients whose dogs seem to grieve just like humans. One dog waited at the window for more than 6 months for a little boy who never came home. The child had been killed in a car accident, and his golden retriever Buddy still waited every afternoon by the door for his return. After waiting several hours, Goldie would sigh deeply, lie down dejectedly, and refuse to play or go for a walk. Her owner called me because the dog was barely eating enough to stay alive. We simply don't know if dogs have a concept of death. As Mark Hauser correctly reminds us in the book Wild Minds, it's perfectly possible that animals are distressed at the strange behavior of another, or suffering because they have lost the social connection of a companion without actually understanding the concept of death. The pain of a loss and an understanding of death are two very separate issues, and given that humans don't understand the concept of death until they are around 8 or 10 years of age, it's a reasonable question to ask. Certainly, there are some amazing anecdotes about animals' behavior in ways that suggest a grieving process. Elephant researchers like Cynthia Moss have observed individuals desperately trying to rouse a dying member of the herd by getting her up on her feet, even trying to get her to eat by stuffing grass in her mouth. Elephants are famous, and accurately so, for not leaving the carcass of a dead family member for days or longer, fondling the body with their feet and trunk repeatedly. Chimpanzees and gorillas have been known to carry the dead body of an infant for days, even though the body itself is starting to rot. A research assistant at the Monterey Bay Bottlenose Dolphin Project observed a group of familiar dolphins swimming in an atypical formation one day. They were swimming so slowly and in such a coordinated way that the observers described it as a procession. In the center of the group was a mother dolphin with a dead neonatal calf on her nose, rostrum, being conveyed slowly through the water in the middle of the group. The human observers were so moved that, out of respect, they stopped following them. Andy Beck, an ethologist at the White Horse Farm in New Zealand, relates an amazing story about a group bereavement he observed in a herd of horses. Three foals died within 72 hours, and for 3 days afterward, the entire herd of horses stood in a circle and faced the foals. They left only to get a drink of water from a nearby stream, and then returned to take up their same position. He's never seen anything like it before or since. But Beck emphasizes that he has found no consistent reaction to death in the farm's horses, even in mares after the death of their own foal. One mare who had delivered malformed and dead twin foals showed no reaction at all, while others have shown signs of true distress when their dead foal was removed. Beck speculates that one factor that may explain the different reactions is the actual biological impact of the death. Looking at it biologically rather than emotionally, a young mare has lost little when her first attempt at reproduction dies. An older mare, however, with no live progeny and few chances remaining to pass on her genes, might react quite differently. It is an interesting hypothesis, and perhaps one that will help us someday understand what is going on in the minds and emotions of other animals when there is a death. The same range of responses that Beck sees in horses is evident in dogs reacting to the death of a human or another dog. Some dogs seem to suffer greatly, while many, if not most, act as though nothing had happened. When my first border collie, Drift, died at 15 and a half, he was euthanized in the house and carried away by the vet. There was no change in behavior in any of the dogs that I could observe after he left. I don't know if it's relevant that Drift was almost blind and deaf when he died, and not a very active part of the group of younger dogs. Even so, they constantly attempted to gain his attention. He basically ignored them unless it was to grump at them if they inadvertently bumped into him in the doorway. And perhaps that affected their reaction, or lack of it, to his death. But some animals do show signs of depression and behave in ways very similar to the ways that grieving humans behave. I've had clients whose dogs seem to pine away for weeks after the death of a doggy friend. In my PhD studies, one of my brood bitches killed her puppies when they were 10 days old. After we took the pathetic little bodies away as soon as the deaths were discovered, the mother spent 3 days howling and searching everywhere, as if looking for her puppies. What we do know is that in some cases it seems to help to let the living animals spend time with the body of the deceased one. I first heard about this practice in horses. White Horse Farm had always taken the bodies of deceased foals away from the mothers as soon as possible because of concerns about cleanliness and disease prevention. Usually the mares reacted with extreme distress, neighing wildly and thrashing around their stalls in a frenzy. However, one day, a foal died when no one was there, and it was many hours before they could remove the body. When they did, the mare paid no attention and continued eating her oats. It seemed that the hours she had spent with her foal's body allowed her to accept its removal a little later. Because of that observation, the farm purposely leaves a dead foal with the mare for several hours and has found that the mares appear calm when the bodies are removed. I was thinking of that story when my own Mist died and left her in state in case it would be helpful for my other dogs. I didn't realize, though, how helpful having Mist's body stay in my home overnight would be for me. It was comforting for me to spend time with her body, feeling it with my hand. I hadn't even known she was sick until a few days earlier, and even though I'd had the weekend to adapt, having her drop out of my life seemed unbearable. I shouldn't be surprised at how valuable being with her body was, since we know from human experience that finding the body of a loved one is an important part of the grieving process. We go to great lengths to find the bodies of people who die, in the knowledge that it is much harder to resolve grief if no body has been recovered. Perhaps in other species as well as humans, the body acts as a bridge between life with our loved ones and life without them, which allows us all to move into the future. Keeping the body of a deceased dog, even just for a few hours, is not for everyone. Some people are put off by the thought of it, and if that's the case, don't even consider it. One of the things that we know about grieving is how very personal it is. Each of us needs to do what feels right and not what other people think we should do. But if you find that you have to euthanize a dear old friend and you're concerned about how your other dogs might react, consider bringing them to the vets to sniff the body before it's sent away. If the vet comes to your home, think about keeping the body for a few hours so that you and your other dogs can pay your respects. There's something else you can do for yourself that your dogs can't, which is enfold yourself in the support of your friends. We all know how important the love of our friends is when we're grieving. I can't think of a time when family, friends, and community are more important than when someone we love dies. But it's different when a dog dies. People's reactions vary, depending on their own relationship with dogs. Some people understand how profound our love for a dog can be, and that the sense of grief and loss can be overwhelming. Others will shrug. Gosh, sorry about your dog. Hey, do you want to go to that party tonight? This remarkable continuum of concern from our friends, from tears of sympathy to the barest of acknowledgments, can make a healthy grieving process difficult. Psychological studies have shown that people go through the same stages of grieving for a pet that they do for a loved human. The progression and resolution may be faster, but pet lovers go through denial, anger, sadness, and eventual resolution, just as we do when grieving for a human family member. As horrible as losing a human is, there is a solid support system for people who have lost close family members. When my father died, a network of people allowed me to stop my life to attend to his death and my grief. Someone showed up at the house to take care of the dogs and the sheep. The university where I was teaching said, "Take as long as you need. We'll cover you." I would never compare the death of a parent to that of a dog. But still, those first few days after Misty's death were agony. When she died, I was blessed with lots of sympathy. But the possibility that I wouldn't go teach the next day was never considered. I think it's important to give yourself some time to stop your life if you can, and acknowledge the passing of a dear friend. Because I have to help my clients deal with loss so often, specializing in serious aggression is like being a cancer specialist. By the time I see them, many cases just can't be cured. When Misty died, I knew there was much that I could do to help myself move through the grieving process. I made a photo collage of her life that first night. I wrote her a letter on another. I still have her ashes, waiting for just the right day to throw a rip-roaring wake at which my buddies and I can tell stories about her, celebrate her life, and probably end up howling with our dogs at the moon. It's important not to let others demean your love for your dog. Like many people, I used to be embarrassed if I got emotional about my dogs or my cat, anticipating at least the thought, if not the comment, "Geez, it's just a pet, get a hold of yourself." I'm over that now. because although I adore logic and rigorous analysis, I treasure honest emotion just as highly. The scientist in me is perfectly comfortable with the animal lover in me, and we are both happy to celebrate together the miracle of our relationship with dogs. Afterward. Luke placed the damp, sandy thing in my hand as if it were a precious egg. He'd never done that before and has never done it since. Keep away is his favorite game, and although he reliably drops his toys to a quiet word, you can tell that it goes against his nature. Luke hogs the ball every second that he can, and had to learn not to mug Pip if she should get it first. But this time, he eased the object into my hands with a kind of serious nobility, and then backed up and sat quietly before me. At first, I didn't even know what it was, just a wet handful of brown. Gradually, I began to distinguish tiny paws and a tail. My hands held a half-drowned chipmunk, chest pumping with shallow breaths, eyes screwed shut, tiny paws clenched. It had just rained 5 inches in 12 hours. There was white water in my front yard, a waterfall by the garage. The chipmunk must have gotten caught in the flooding that overtook the farm in the drama of a summer thunderstorm. Chipmunks are generally bad guests on Wisconsin farms, chewing holes in sacks of grain and nesting in boxes of old photographs in the attic. But this gasping little mammal found her way into my heart, so I cleaned her off and warmed her up. In half an hour, she was warm and dry and not at all pleased to be in a box on my kitchen counter. Luke and I watched her skitter across the garage when I let her out. I will never know why Luke picked her up and handed her to me, ever so gently. He was not being predatory, nor was he being playful. You can't miss his intense play stalk when we play ball. His head and tail drop while he crouches in anticipation of the chase. But this time, he didn't look playful or predatory. He was quiet and serious, but soft-eyed, moving as if he were in slow motion. What was he thinking when he eased her into his jaws and presented her to me like a newborn baby at a hospital? Was he saving her life? The idea seems foolish to me. My other border collies hunt ground-dwelling mammals with a passion. But then Luke pays little attention to mice and baby rabbits, and is always gentle with baby lambs. Luke has risked his own life to save mine, although I'll never know if he was purposefully saving me from danger or just getting in on the action. Perhaps he found the chipmunk confusing, out of place, and was handing her to me to get things back to normal. I don't know. You already know that Luke is one of my best friends. After a hard morning loading sheep onto the truck, Luke and I sit together with a closeness born of hard work, mutual respect, and some undefinable connection that he and I have always had. But I'll never know what was on his mind when he picked up that soggy chipmunk. It's just not the kind of thing that dogs and humans can discuss. We are so much like our dogs in so many ways, sharing the joys of a playful frolic on the spring grass, cuddling up for naps together on sleepy Sunday afternoons, equally excited about a walk in the cool fall woods. And yet, we are a cosmos apart, separated by individual and species differences, too vast ever to bridge. As Henry Beston said in The Outermost House, "For the animal shall not be measured by man. In a world older and more complete than ours, they move finished and complete, gifted with the extension of the senses we have lost or never attained, living by voices we shall never hear. They are not brethren, they are not underlings, they are other nations caught with ourselves in the net of life and time, fellow prisoners of the splendor and travail of the earth." The miracle is that in one sense, it doesn't matter if I ever understand what Luke was doing. Love is not the same thing as understanding. Everyone who's been perplexed by his or her spouse or child knows that. Of course, it matters greatly that people who love dogs understand enough about them to provide a good environment for them. That understanding allows them to help their dogs to be healthy, happy, and polite, rather than inadvertently hindering them. The first thing that every dog trainer learns is that most of the problems people have with their dogs and dogs have with their people are due to misunderstandings that could have been prevented. Indeed, the goal of this book has been to promote an increased level of understanding of human and dog behavior, in the hope that it improves the relationships between people and their dogs. But there are different levels of understanding, and perhaps there's a level of understanding that's not necessary between us and our dogs. Perhaps there's value in a relationship that strives to share what it can, and that accepts, deeply and peacefully, its limitations. I like that Luke is not a small, furry, four-legged human. I am blessed with many human friends, and I don't need dogs as substitutes. Some of what I get from my dogs is similar to what I get from my human relationships. But just as I can't discuss world peace with Tulip, there's something that I get from my connection to her that I can't get from my other human friends. I'm not even sure what it is, but it's deep and primal and good. It has something to do with staying connected to the earth and to sharing the planet with other living things. We humans are in such a strange position. We are still animals whose behavior reflects that of our ancestors, yet we are unique, unlike any other animal on Earth. Our distinctiveness separates us and makes it easy to forget where we came from. Perhaps dogs help us to remember the depth of our roots, reminding us, the animals at the other end of the leash, that we may be special, but we are not alone. No wonder we call them our best friends. To my mom and dad. Acknowledgements. This book was cultivated with my mother's love of dogs and my father's love of literature. I am filled with gratitude for all that my father, G. Clark Bean, was able to give me, and for all that my mother, Pamela Bean, continues to provide. My academic mentors, Jeffrey Bayliss and Charles Snowden, are still a source of inspiration and support. I will forever be indebted to them both for all that they have taught me, and for their ability to combine critical thinking with their deep love for animals and their curiosity about them. I am also grateful to the Department of Zoology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for its support during my PhD research, and at present for my course, The Biology and Philosophy of Human-Animal Relationships. I don't know what I did to deserve every author's dream agent, but the wisdom and support of Jennifer Gates of Zachary, Schuster, and Harmsworth has meant more to me than I can ever say. I am equally grateful to my editor, Leslie Meredith, whose belief in the book has always been stalwart, and who was invaluable at many stages of the writing. Sloppy kisses to her dog Dylan, with a promise of doggy treats coming when he least expects it. My sincere thanks to Maureen O'Neill and all at Ballantine for their support and hard work. This book never could have been written without the staff at Dog's Best Friend Limited, without the dedication and professionalism of Jackie Boland, Karen London, Amy Moore, and Denise Sweetland. I never would have been able to leave the office and write it home every morning for such a long time. I am also grateful to all of the Dog's Best Friend Limited dog training class instructors and volunteers who skillfully and lovingly educate the animals at both ends of the leash almost every week of the year. Much of the good in this book is due to the thoughtful comments of a group of friends and colleagues, Jeffrey Bayliss, Jackie Boland, and Lindsay, Karen London, Beth Miller, Amy Moore, Denise Sweetland, and Charles Snowden provided thoughtful feedback that substantially improved the book. I am also grateful to Franz Duval for reviewing some of the sections on chimpanzee and bonobo behavior, and to Stephen Suomi for our discussions about personality in primates. I was lucky to have the interest and support of several people at the Vilas County Zoo in Madison, Wisconsin, and thank Mary Schmidt and Jim Hubing especially for providing opportunities for me to schmooze with their chimps and with Mooka, the orangutan. I could never have finished the book on deadline without the support and help of dear friends during my dog Luke's battle with soft tissue sarcoma. Dimitri Bilgear, Jackie Boland, Harriet Irwin, Patrick Momartz, and Renee Rivetta generously assisted the daily transporting of Luke to the University of Wisconsin-Madison Veterinary Medical Teaching Hospital for radiation treatments. I am also grateful to four very special veterinarians: John Daly of the River Valley Veterinary Clinic, Christine Burgess of the University of Wisconsin Veterinary Medical Teaching Hospital, Kim Conley of the Silver Springs Animal Wellness Center, and Chris Besent, DVM and Chinese medicine specialist, for all their skill and support during that challenging time. All my Vermont Valley Vixen friends should know how special our monthly brunches are to me. I am everlastingly grateful that I live nestled in a countryside brimming with beauty and good friends. My dear friends Dave and Julie Egger, Dimitri Bilgear, Karen Bloom, Karen Lasker, Beth Miller, and Patrick Momartz all were important in their own ways, and I am a lucky woman to have them as friends. I'm equally lucky to have two profoundly supportive and amazing sisters, Wendy Barker and Liza Pyatt, who, even though we live far apart, are always close to my heart. I am indebted to Mary Vinson and the Coulee Region Humane Society in La Crosse, Wisconsin, for their generous permission to use photos from the book Tales from the Heart by Susan Fox, with photos by Kathy Eckerman. I thank Franz Duval in allowing the use of his photographs of chimpanzees from the books Chimpanzee Politics and Peacemaking Among Primates. Karen London also deserves grateful thanks for her photographic contributions. Zachary Sauer's research assistant was greatly appreciated and deserves thanks as well. Special thanks to Dr. Cecilia Suarez, a veterinarian and marriage and family therapist, who graciously shared the phrase, the other end of the leash, which is also the name of her consulting business. Dr. Suarez offers seminars and consultations to veterinarians and their staff members on communication and other topics related to the human side of veterinary practice. The thousands of dogs and their owners with whom I have worked have taught me more than I can express. Thanks for letting me learn and grow along with you. I give grateful thanks to a list of amazingly talented dog trainers and behaviorists who, over the years, have provided skill and inspiration to me and thousands of others. Carol Benjamin, Sheila Booth, William Campbell, Jean Donaldson, Donna Duford, Job Michael Evans, Ian Dunbar, Trish King, Karen Pryor, Pam Reed, Terry Ryan, Pia Silvani, Sue Sternberg, and Barbara Wodehouse. I list those names with absolute assurance that I will remember yet one more absolutely essential person the day after the book is released. Whoever you are, thanks, and my apologies. Kudos and warm wishes to Doug McConnell and Larry Myler, my favorite co-hosts of all time. I also thank Ricky Aaron, who has taught me virtually nothing about dogs because he made me laugh when he called me up and begged me to mention his name. My friend and colleague Nancy Raffetto deserves her own special thanks for having the vision and the courage to join with me in opening up Dogs Best Friend Training Limited in 1988, at a time when applied animal behaviorists were practically unknown. Looking back, I'm still amazed that two PhDs knowing virtually nothing about business, but a lot about behavior, managed to launch what is now a thriving enterprise. Thanks for riding the whitewater with me. I could never have done it alone. Acknowledgements and admiration to all at the magazine The Bark, the New Yorker of dog magazines, for their support of my writing and their exquisite efforts to combine beautiful writing and great art with a passion for dogs and their humans. My sweetest and most extravagant thanks go to my dear friend Jim Billings, whose friendship, support, and wise advice have been like food and water to me over the last year and a half. And finally, I declare my love and admiration for Luke, Tulip, Pip, and Lassie, four remarkable individuals who have enhanced and enriched my life beyond description.
We hope you've enjoyed this novel audio production of The Other End of the Leash, Why We Do What We Do Around Dogs by Patricia McConnell. Narrated by Ellen Archer. Executive producer, Michelle Katz. Audiobook copyright 2017 by Novel Audio. Print and ebook copyright 2016 by Patricia McConnell, PhD. All rights reserved. If you liked this recording and want to see a full catalog of our titles, please visit www.novelaudio.com. Thanks for listening.